canonization. Books that had trouble getting in. We can take from all of Chazal, plenty of material, it's all the Chaver, and see what they had, what the problems they had with certain books, the five books of Yechezkel, Esther, Mishlei, Shir, Shir, and Koheles. We see all the problems they have with those five books. We can create criteria whereby the rabbis felt you must have this if you're going to be in the Bible, which excludes what we call Sfarim Chitzoniyim. Remember the two opinions about what that comprises, the New Testament or the Apocrypha. Yes.
The test is on the how many pages are there? The first comma.
These three topics. Chaver has contents, authorship, canonization.
And sort of like that.
Now that's not all that we did until now. We did after that Mesorah, and in the beginning of last just before with the vacation, Targumin, language.
And the test is on that also.
No. That'll be the next.
So it's one of the three things you said:
contents, authorship, canonization. Okay. Now, Bible has obviously been translated into many languages. The two most important languages for us are Greek and Aramaic. It appears from Chazal that the Bible was translated first into Greek before it was translated into Aramaic. It was commissioned by Talmi, who had a vast library. Kingdoms that ruled part of Greek after the split up of Alexander the Great's kingdom. Right? It says that I use the word commissioned. It might appear from the Gemara that he forced, but whatever it is, he commissioned a certain amount of rabbis, a large amount of rabbis, close to the number 70. In our sources, some say 70, some say 72. Doesn't matter. This would appear to be the origins of this work called the Septuagint. See the word sept? Okay. Approximately 70 scholars were involved with this translation. This was done after Ezra and Nehemiah were no longer around. Okay, the Talmud in Megillah Daf Tes Amud Aleph, and if you would like to call it a Mishnah in Maseches Sofrim. At the end of Maseches Avodah Zarah, you will find a whole host of these small, like, I guess you'd call them a Mishnah. I don't know. They look like Toseftas, right? Maseches Gerim, Maseches Kutim, Maseches Tefillin, Maseches Maseches Smachos. Their status is debated amongst the Rishonim. Okay, this is the very first time you've ever heard any of this. So be it. One of those small Masechtas is called Maseches Sofrim. Sefer Sofrim discusses a lot of issues that deal with liturgies and Tanakh. What Haftorahs should we say on Shabbos? We have aliyahs. How many sukkim do you have to read when you're going to? Sounds like it's parallel to Maseches Megillah. Right? Sounds right. Okay. So, just as a quick tangent, as a function of what this Machlokas Rishonim is. We paskin that if you miss the four extraneous additions to the Shemona Esrei during a service of Meitshuva, that you don't have to daven again. You know what I'm talking about? Zochrein al-Chaim, Michamocha, right? Okay, the Shulchan Aruch paskin is like the rush, that you don't have to say Shemona Esrei, only for HaMelech HaKadosh. But those four, if you miss those four, you still continue daven, right? You're familiar with that psak, right? We just finished the service of Meitshuva. Right, the reason the Rosh says for this, that this psak, is because it's not found in the Talmud. Okay? That's what he was saying. It's not in the Talmud. We're not going to say Shema Esrei again because of it. Got it? Tosfos, all over Shas, in Maseches Brachos, Maseches Megillah, Maseches Tainus, paskins that if you miss any of these four, even the last one at Sim Shalom, you've got to say the whole Shema Esrei again. Right? And he says, because it's found in Maseches Sofrim. right? When the Rosh says it's not found in the Talmud, right, he must feel that he knows it's in the Sefer Sofrim. He must feel the Sefer Sofrim is not part of the Talmud. Another Mishnah. It's some later edition. I don't know what it's called. It's not a Tosefta, because a Tosefta also has the value of a Mishnah. It's a Brisa. Alright? Okay, I'm just putting it out there. Maseches Sofrim has the story of the 70 rabbis who put together the Greek translation of the Tanakh. Okay, you got it? Okay, there's a number of other places just to finish the conversation where Tosfos says, the Gemara says we should say this Haftorah, but Maseches Sofrim says we should say a different Haftorah, and we prefer Maseches Sofrim. So Tosfos seems to put a great value on this Masechet. If you have a chance, take a look, open up on Masechet of Zara, look in the back, and you'll see 10, 12 of these small Masechet. Okay? So, what is the story? These 70 rabbis saw that the Torah has some contradictions in it, and some inconsistencies, and some problems that may come up with the Greek speaking audience that Talmi wants this, for whom Talmi wants this Tanakh, right? So they made some changes. And what's very valuable about these two sources, the Gemara Megillah Daf Tes and the Maseches Sofrim, is that they list the changes and why they made these changes. Okay, I'm just telling you the story. What the changes are actually has very little importance for us. We have a Septuagint. You go to the New York Public Library, you go to any you go to Barnes & Noble, you buy a Septuagint, right? It's not going to resemble anything like what this Gemara talks about, right? This Gemara may be the origins of the Septuagint, got it? But we don't have that book anymore. The Septuagint has been in the hands of the church for as long as it exists. That's their official Bible translation. They admit that Jesus spoke, or that the Gospels who wrote, whatever it is, wrote in Hebrew or Aramaic, and then was translated into Greek. So the Septuagint is not even an original for the Christians. Got it? But that's their official. Right? By all means, there are all kinds of translations. There's Latin translations. There's a very famous lineup of six translations of the Christian Bible in columns. All right, not important for us. The issue is that translations can change a whole text. One word, right, in a pasuk like this, Hine ha'alma hara v'yoledet ben, right, where Yeshayahu tries to convince the king to have faith because better days are coming, right? Whether this word means young maiden or virgin may change the whole mahut of the perek. Okay? Virgin birth is a very important tenet of fundamentalist Christianity. Right? And they base it on this pasuk in Yeshayahu, chapter 7. Right, so of course the Septuagint reads virgin here, but you have to go to the original Hebrew. Okay, maybe in your year in Israel, you studied, you heard a lecture from someone named Usher Wade, Rabbi Usher Wade, former Catholic priest. He's been teaching the Eshet Torah for the last 25 years. His conversion from being, he's really an up and coming young Catholic priest who converted because of this pasuk, who started studying translations because of this pasuk. He saw that the word Alma, right, meaning virgin, as a reference to Jesus, can't fit this pasuk. One, because Hine implies that you're going to see it now, the whole, it's before you, right? Two, this word means is pregnant, not will be pregnant. Three, the whole point of the story here is that you're supposed to have faith now that the Assyrians are not going to destroy you because of this thing that's about to happen. And his son, the man hearing this, his son Chizkiyahu, did save them from the Assyrians. Jews were forced into debates about whether or not this is a reference to Jesus. And you have to be very careful. It's very easy to win this debate on philological grounds. This word does not mean virgin, right? On grammatical grounds, this word does not mean will become pregnant, right? And on contextual grounds, this is supposed to be something that's happening now that's going to give you faith for now, not because 600 years from now a virgin's going to give birth, right? How is that supposed to give this king, Ochaz, faith that he's going to outlast the Assyrians? Got it? So it's very easy to win this argument. It's just to be very careful. Because if you were seen to be blasphemous in this argument, they'd kill you on the spot. You know what I'm saying? They actually did one time in a debate around the turn of the first millennium, which is when they forced us into these, because they thought that when year 1000 was coming, Jesus was going to return, and only if the Jews are ready for mass conversion will he succeed in returning. So the Jews were forced into these debates and disputes, right? And you have to be very careful. You didn't know whether it was better to lose or better to win. If you lost, then they'd slaughter you for not converting. If you won, you have to be careful because you might have seen you could appear to be blasphemous, right? So it's all about the real thing. It's about the translation of this word. Rabbi Wade started to look at the chapter when he was learning this chapter. He said, this can't be a reference to Jesus. It doesn't fit the context, the word, the grammar. It doesn't fit. So he looked at all the other places where the word Alma appears in the King James Bible. King James is the first authoritative translation of the Christian Bible into English. And he saw that every other time that the word Alma appears in the Bible, it's translated in the King James Bible as
young maiden.
Young maiden. In fact, some of those references refer to married women. But here in Isaiah 7:14, it's virgin. He said, we're being sold a bill of goods. Right? Now, there's an amazing theory. This is going to come out about 2 or 3 weeks from now. Amazing theory that when Jews were forced into this kind of commentary and disputation, this revolutionized Jewish commentary. Right? What are these three concepts? Philology, which is why I'm talking about this. Philology means, what does the word mean? What's the translation of the word, this word? Context, it's happening now, not 600 years from now. Grammar. These are three foundations of something that's changing because Jews are forced into these disputations. What are these three foundations of that you see starting to proliferate just around the turn of the first millennia when Christians are forcing Jews into these debates? What's happening? Rashi didn't make this up. Rashi was part of it. For 900, 1,000 years, Jews are studying the Bible from what did we have? All we had was Brachos, Medrash Rabbah, Medrash Tanchuma, a couple of out of the way additional Midrashim on Treyasar, on Tehillim, on Mishlei, the Agadah and the Gemara, and Targumim. What started to proliferate now? Give me a three-letter word. Pshat, of course. Pshat. These are rules of pshat. Pshat means to lav sheet, to skin the top of an animal. Is lav sheet. Just give me the plain, simple meaning. Don't darshan Jesus from this. Because it doesn't fit. Now, look, the fact is, if you have a dogma, dogma is not always interested in pshat, right? Anyone who leafs through Maseches Zvachim and Menachos knows most of how we darshan Pesukim and Vayikra to come to how we had the sacrificial order, knows that most of what the Gemara determines is based not on pshat, but on drash, right? Fine, fair enough. We'll have our sacrificial order on drash. But some of the Jews argue here, Ramban said this specifically in his disputation, we don't burn people at the stake because they don't accept our drash. You know what I'm saying? In other words, you're killing people for not accepting that this word means virgin. In one of these disputations, Nebuch, they killed him right on the spot for saying this. It was snarky. He said, of course this can't be Jesus. The person in this verse is saving us from the Assyrians, it says. Jesus didn't even save us from the Romans. They had their way with him. So how could this verse be Jesus? And they killed him right on his head for blasphemy. Right? That's how you deal with someone who makes a good argument against you. You just kill him. Right? Yes.
Is the word maiden the best? Like, Because maiden can mean, like, it often connotes a virgin.
It doesn't necessarily, but I will agree with you that this word elem, because the word elem appears much more often in alma. The word elem in alma for a boy or a girl denotes youth. Okay, you could be a married alma, you could be a single alma. It denotes youth. You could probably be called an elem or an alma until about 25. All right? Miriam is called an alma when she's helping her brother in the water. Rivka is called an alma when she's giving water to the... And it's interesting, because Rivka is called both alma and a few psukim later called Zula. All right, so one is denoting her age, and the other is denoting her sexual experience.
Doesn't that connect to right?
I don't think so. I think that that's
also, I mean, both those examples are...
Well, Alma is denoting her youthful vigor in helping a stranger. And Besul, oh, by the way, you know. Okay. So, Adarabha, I mean, look, I'll admit that kind of question is debated in the Rishonim. Like when it says, Hashem told Moshe, V'nil'u mitzrayim limtso mayim min they'll do something to get water during the plague of blood. And then when it actually happened, the Pasuk says, V'lo yochlu. So Rashbam says, V'nilu means V'lo yochlu. Rashi disagrees. He says, if that's what it means, then the Torah should have used the same word both times. So the sentiment of your thought is debated, that kind of parshanut. But here, I don't see it. Three psukim apart, Alma Basula. Why use two different words to say mean the same thing? One is denoting her youthful vigor, youthful specifically, and one is denoting her sexual experience. So, anyway, this is where pshat parshanut arises out of our desire for good translation. You know what I'm saying? If you're translating from one language into another, for good sense, the first thing you got to do is be true to your pshat, right? Okay, so that's why I'm not going to elaborate. on the changes they made, there were 18 of them mentioned in each of the sources, and it's interesting, they both have the same amount of changes, but they're not all consistent. About two or three that each one uses that the other one doesn't have. So altogether, about 20 differences. First is very famously Bereishis Bara Elokim. Right? Greeks did not believe in what we call ex nihilo, yesh me'ayin. So they changed Bereishis Bara Elokim, which might mean something called Bereishis created God. Right? The Greeks do not believe in even if they believed in one unified God, it doesn't matter whether it's one or many, but they had to be created by something else. The Greeks had a word for that thing. It's called hiyuli. Right? Made famous by Ramban in the beginning of his Perish al Hazori. He talks about this Greek hiyuli. Okay, so they changed it to Elohim Bara Bereishis. All right, anyway, there are all additional changes. Rashi, in his Perush to the Torah, often, when he gets up to one of these changes, will refer to it. Okay? Just when you get up to a Rashi, for instance, where it says that the Israelites spent 430 years in Egypt. Very difficult pasuk. They spent 430 years in Egypt. 430? Avram was told 400. Forget about the tradition we have that it was only 210. That's Vidit Taurus, but I'm just talking about the Torah itself. Right? So is it 430 or 400? The Torah shouldn't be contradictory. Okay? So the rabbis made a change in that text. They said this time they spent in Egypt and other lands was 430. All right? I'm not going to get into that. Just on that pasuk, Rashi refers to a number of solutions to this apparent contradiction. And then he says at the end, this was one of the verses that the rabbis in the Septuagint changed. he's Rashi is admitting this is a very difficult verse, right? Okay. Yechezkel, chapter 20, refers to the great sinning of Israel in Egypt. They became polytheistic with the Egyptians. We don't have a picture of that from the Torah, but we do have a picture of that from Yechezkel. So Abravanel says, based on Yechezkel, the 38 extra years were a punishment because you became so evil and so wicked. So I added on, okay, I usually don't, but I added on more years. It's an unusual kind of parish. But anyway, I'm just be aware that Rashi sometimes will say, this is one of the psukim that the Greek, they changed for the Greeks. And you can say, what does that mean? Now you know. Okay? All right, I'll tell you just one final word on this. There's a debate amongst the scholars whether this was good for the Jews or bad for the Jews, right? Have you ever heard? Is this good for the Jews or bad for the Jews? Why would it be bad for the Jews? There's Gemara Menachos that says the day that we were forced, they say we were coerced into writing this translation was worse than the day of the Egel. And so, and there are other scholars who claim from other sources that they felt this was a good thing for the Jews. It's debate of why I'm not speaking to you in Hebrew now. Right? When I started teaching in this very class in 1983, right? You had to teach in Hebrew in this school, right? So tough. You don't understand it. Okay, don't go to this school. Go to a different part of the school. We don't have to speak Hebrew. We're not going to talk to you in Hebrew. All right? But it was called EMC then. In EMC, you had to teach in Hebrew, and all the classes were Hebrew people. Right? What's happened in 30 years? Right? It happened within 5 years. Right? We were losing students, whatever it is. I don't know. But it's become more increasingly difficult. So now that people wanted to study Torah, but I can't do it in Hebrew. So is it a good thing that now the Torah is available to those Greek speakers? So the Gemara seems to say it's you're surrendering, right? They want to study Torah. Or they're saying, but no, now the Torah is available for more people. Let me tell you, when Rashi finished his parish to the Talmud, do you know that there were people who said, why do we need Rashi for the Talmud? Now people are going to rely on Rashi to understand the Talmud. Right? You hear that? Some things you hear from art scrolls, and that always happens. Okay? Now, there it goes. No one's going to study Talmud anymore. We have Rashi! Okay, so this is a debate that raged on in the time of Chazal. Just informing you. This is altogether different from the Aramaic translations. Okay? And I want to divide the Aramaic translations into two categories. One is the Aramaic translation that was popular in Babel, and one are the Aramaic translations, I say there were many more, that were popular in Israel. Okay? They are first and foremost very distinguishable by their type of Aramaic. Now, I don't suppose that any of you... Too many of you have traveled far and wide into Talmud Yerushalmi. But there's a Gemara in Maseches Chagiga that says, if you're used to learning the Bavli, and you try to now start studying Talmud Yerushalmi, you're going to have a hard time with it. Bavli was aware that there was an earlier Talmud. Talmud Yerushalmi was finished 100 years before the Bavli. And it's true, the Talmud Yerushalmi is much harder to learn than the Talmud Bavli. For one thing, the Talmud Bavli had another 100 years of development. Another thing is, Talmud Bavli has Rashi, the Talmud Yerushalmi doesn't. So the more recent commentaries to the Talmud Yerushalmi are like, they're like holding your hand. Similar Gemaras between the Bavli and Yerushalmi, Rashi assumes you know the Gemara a lot more than the commentaries to the Talmud Yerushalmi. Right? They're in Hebrew, to be sure, but they feel that the person reading this page needs a lot more help than Rashi thinks his audience needed to manage their way through the Bible. I'm just saying, the Yerushalmi is written in what's called Eretz Yisrael Aramaic. It's a different Aramaic. Okay, so the first thing is language. they're both called Aramaic, to be sure, right? But the language is very different. And it's a function of the difference between the Talmud Yerushalmi and the Talmud Bavli. Right? It's amazing. Think of how much English has evolved from Beowulf and Chaucer to Shakespeare to our own day. Right? That's just 1,000 years. So don't be so surprised that other languages should evolve differently. Hebrew, amazingly, someone who never opened up a Tanakh, but is a secular Israeli today, right, can open up a 3,000-year-old text and make their way through. As long as they know basic Hebrew grammar. Right? That's amazing. It means that there's been a non-stop study of this text. Right? And the opposite is also true. Someone who knows the Tanakh fully, right? The whole introduction to Hebrew is that you know every word of Tanakh. You can go to Israel today, yes, you won't be able to buy a television, right? You might not know what an umbrella is, right? But you'll be able to manage, right? That's what Eliezer Ben Yehuda did. He had to take biblical words. The word for rain is matar, so the word for umbrella is a mitria, right? Okay, so but the basis is the words of Tanakh, right? So that's the first. That's a fundamental first. Is the language two? Is this is we'll start to get very interesting. Is the Targum Onkelos is just I'll give you just is the Babylonian one? I'd say it's about 80%. The Aramaic dictionary word of the word he's commenting in the Bible. Follow what I'm saying? There's some sections of Torah where Targum Onkelos just goes off on a total limb, and you wouldn't recognize that he's commenting on these words, like Yaakov's blessings to the tribes, right? When he blesses Dan, Onkelos says this is talking about Shimshon. Yaakov didn't mention Shimshon, right? So Targum Onkelos in certain areas of the Torah takes liberties, but 80% of the time he's just straight pshat. You hear what I'm saying? Lo tivashel gdi b'chalev imo is going to be don't cook a kid in its mother's milk in Aramaic, right? As opposed to Targum Yonason. Now here's another. Now this is a misnomer. That word, what you really should say is Targum Yerushalmi. Yerushalmi Targumim, the ones written in Eretz Yisrael, take profound liberties with the biblical text. Almost always. Almost every part. There's hardly a pasuk where the Targum Yerushalmi just translates into Aramaic. I'd switch. Only 20% is the straight Aramaic translation. Right? Okay, and many of them are halachic. Many of them are even agadic. Why was Moshe's mother able to hide Moshe for 3 months? Who cares how long she was able to hide him? The Targum Yonason writes, Moshe was born after 6 months. The Egyptians, anytime someone got married, would check 9 months later to see if there's a baby in the house, so she had 3 months to hide him because he was born early. Right? That's an opinion that doesn't appear anywhere in Chazal. There is a list in Maseches Rosh Hashanah of all the 6-month babies. Moshe's not on it. And there's a Gemara in Sota that gives another explanation for why she was able to hide him for 3 months. Right? She was already pregnant with whom they separated, the Gemara says. Right? Rashi somehow chooses this Targum Yonason explanation. But I'm going ahead of myself. Yerushalmi Targumim, the ones written in Eretz Yisrael, are written as commentary. Okay? A woman shall not wear men's kalim. Targum Onkelos just says, a woman shall not wear men's garments. Targum Yonason says, a woman shall not wear talis and tefillin. Okay, he's explaining. It's more explanatory than translation. Get it? Okay. Now here's another fundamental difference. Difference number three is that the Babylonian Targum above is only on the Torah. And that was written by Onkelos. Heard of him? Chazal say he was a convert. pig. Now there's another person in the Yerushalmi called Achilas. Right, there's a debate amongst the Rishonim whether that's the same person or not. Yerushalmi and Ayin sounds like Ayin, Ayin. Like Yanko, 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 Yanko. Right? The way you pronounce an Ayin is almost guttural if you're really pronouncing it properly. Right? You hear a real Yemenite pronounce an Ayin, it's like it almost sounds like a Nun in there. Okay. All right. Anyway, the Korban Aida on the Mishalmi says that it's the same person. There's another person called Achilas who's also translating things into Aramaic. All right, I'm not gonna, just you should recognize the name. And so Unkelus is only on the Torah. Don't ever get caught talking about Targum Unkelus to Yehoshua. All right, no such thing. The Targum to Nevi'im, all right, is Jonas and Ben Uziel. I think we touched upon this before. Vacation. Talking to Nevi'im is Jonas son ben Uziel, a student of Hillel. Okay? But only to Nevi'im, not Ketuvim. Right? There's no Targum to Ketuvim as far as the Gemara is concerned. Okay? Anyone ever hear the reason why the Gemara doesn't want a Targum to Ketuvim?
Secret to Mashiach.
The secret to Mashiach is somewhere in Ketuvim. It doesn't say in the Gemara where. That's why we have Rashi in commentaries. The secret of Mashiach is somewhere in Ketuvim. The assumption is that, but wait a second, if it's in Daniel, correct, but if it's cryptic in Daniel, shouldn't it remain cryptic in the Aramaic translation of Daniel? Well, not if
it's a commentary.
It's a commentary, right? All right. The assumption of the Gemara is that a Targum of Ketuvim would more readily resemble Yonatan ben Uziel than Unkelus. Unkelus would come up to these very cryptic verses in chapter 9 and chapter 12 of Daniel, right? The Malbim's perish to the end of Daniel is crazy. He predicted in 1868 that in 1915 there would be a world war involving Germany, and that's going to be Mechanes Gog and Magog. He brings all kinds of tzukim from Daniel, Yecheskel, even the Torah to prove this. Anyway, the end of Daniel does have hints at end of days predictions, and the assumption is that if there were a Targum, it would resemble Jonas ben Uziel, and it would reveal it. So I don't want to reveal that. So there is no Targum to Ketuvim. All right, a few points I would like to mention to you. One is that if you open up any Ketuvim with the Kros Gedolos in here, you will find a Targum to Ketuvim. There is a Targum to Ksuvim. All of Ksuvim. Even Divrei Yamin. Tell them every. All of Ksuvim is a Targum. So is that violating the Gemara? Even Daniel has a Targum. So the answer is all these Sfarim are printed with it. Was there ever a Psak that came out when Jews were allowed to start printing in 1724? Stay away from the Ksuvim. I don't know. All I can tell you is we don't know the authority of it. We don't know where it comes from. We don't know who. I have a name on the Torah and the Nevi'im Targum. I don't have a name on the Ksuvim one. That's it. I don't know what else to say. Okay? I will just say one thing, is that there was a Tshuva b'Chassam Sofer where he says, I would prefer that Ksuvim not be printed. With commentaries, fine. With Rashi, Radak, Ibn Ezra, where it's available, right? But I don't think you should print Ksuvim with Targum, because the Gemara says it doesn't exist. We don't know who wrote it. And here is his proof. This is amazing. At the end of chapter 1 of Rus, remember Naomi's trying to send her daughters-in-law back home, right? One goes home. You're with me? You all with me, Orpah? And Ruth cleaves to her. So she still pushes Ruth to go home, still, even after Orpah left. She goes, go with her followers, come on, she's going, right? And then Ruth comes up with a long soliloquy about your people are my people, your God is my God, you go out, right? Famous line, right? So according to Chazal, Gemara Nivamos, this is her official conversion. She had not converted before. She's now officially joining the people of Israel. How that works, not important. When she says, where you die, I'll die, this is all part of a dialogue, right? She said, you know, we have a rule in Israel that there are, if you could be put to death for violating things that you wouldn't think of as a Moabite. She goes, where you die, I'll die. And then she says, let me tell you what those four deaths are. And this is what the Chassam Sofer points out. It's there in Rus. It says, they'll stone you, they'll burn you, they will decapitate you, and they will crucify you. The fourth death is Tzlivas Hesa, which is what the Gemara usually calls crucifixion. Right? Slav is a cross. So Chassam Sofer used that as proof that Targum B'Ksuvim, Rus is B'Ksuvim, should be excised from all of the B'Ksuvim. Right? With all due respect, whenever someone says that, respect usually doesn't follow, but Chassam Sofer may not have known that there is a censored text of Maseches Sanhedrin that describes strangulation very much, for at least a moment, like a crucifixion. It says when you strangle someone, now this is in the uncensored text of the of Maseches Sanhedrin, just the Daphne a few weeks ago, that you have to put his back against the plank that goes vertical, and his shoulders against the plank about two-thirds of the way up against across his shoulders, right? And then you take a rope this way, a rope that way, and you pull from both directions until he's strangled. And you have to leave him hanging there for a few seconds, and then this is the censored text. That's how they killed that heretic. No. All right? So it looks for a moment that what you have to do for Chenek looks, it could be called Slivas Kesa. He's hanging from a cross, right? So anyway, I'm just putting it out there that no one seems to follow this Chassam Sofer. Go into any farm store and buy a Koheles, and you'll see it comes with a Targum. Right? But here's the point. This is what the Gemara was afraid of. The Targumim to Ksuvim, you wouldn't even know that it's talking about this Pasuk. Right? Okay? The Targumim, especially to Esther, very famously. And there are two different ones like this. The Targumim in Ksuvim are, I would say, 2% reflect the Pshat of the Pasuk. It hardly ever reflects the Pshat of the Pasuk. You hear? If you can handle the Aramaic, it's some very interesting stuff. All right? It's hardly ever the real translation of the Pasuk. Yes?
I didn't understand the root thing. Is the Hebrew text, does that say crucifixion?
No. The Hebrew text, the verse just says, I'll die where you die. No, it's the Gemara that says.
Okay, so
Gemara that interpreted the dialogue. She says, where you sleep, she said, you know, we have laws of Gilui Arayos. In Moab, you sleep wherever you want. You can sleep with any man, you can marry him. So it was, well, will you sleep, I'll sleep. I'll follow the Jewish laws of Gilui Arayos. Because we have rules that even determine where you can walk. We have Hilchos Shabbos and Tchum Shabbos. You're not allowed to walk beyond the boundaries of the city. This doesn't appear in Rus. This is a dialogue that the rabbis introduced to explain this long soliloquy. Because where you walk, I'll walk.
Right? So is that's considered a translation of it?
This is like everything else in Ksuvim often does, which is adds to the text.
So I don't understand how this addition to the text is related to the problem of translating it to Aramaic.
Well, in this particular case, the Chassam Sofer thought that it wasn't a Jewish translator. You follow me? It was a Christian translator who introduced crucifixion into a mode of how Jews commit four Mises Beis Din. So I used this censored text of Maseches Sanhedrin to say that it's possible that a Jewish reader translating Rus in the 2nd century CE into Aramaic thought that Chenek looks a little bit like the way Jesus was killed. And there's a censored text of Sanhedrin that seems to agree.
Okay.
Everyone following with that? Okay. I just brought that in to say that true to form, the Targum to Ksuvim are very, very explanatory. They don't stay true to the simple pshat of the text. That you'll find such things in Agadah, in the Gemara in Yevamos. That happens on every second page of the Talmud. Right? But when I find a Targum, you'll forgive me if I want just a translation. Right? Okay? Alright, so herein is the basic differences. Just keep in mind these differences when approaching the text. Now, if you open up a Mikros Gedolos, I'm not sure if I have one here that... Yeah, this one does. Here. You find here, you have Unkelos, of course, in this here. Right? This is a full Chumash with Mikros Gedolos. You find Unkelos, let me know what that is. But on some pages you find Jonas and Beniziel, right? Which I've already expressed to you is a misnomer. Jonas and Beniziel didn't write on the Torah, the Gemara says. Unkelos did. But this Mikros Gedolos has Jonas and Beniziel in it. And, to boot, Yerushalmi. And there's two Eretz Yisrael Targumim, both playing a lot of liberties with the text, as I told you, the Eretz Yisrael Targumim did. Right? So I just want you, when you leave this class after this semester, that you open up a Masechta Sofrim, you open up a Mikros Gedolos, and your kid says, what is that? That you don't have to wonder. All right? Targum Jonas and Benuziel and Yerushalmi are twins. Jonas and Benuziel, the one that appears here, is probably a misnomer that someone wrote these words on top of a manuscript. And instead of translating it Targum Yerushalmi, and we have about 10 of them, 10 different ones, which means it was written in Eretz Yisrael, with Eretz Yisrael language, taking liberties with the text, but not by Yonasan. Someone mistakenly wrote Yonasan. And it stuck. This is not Yonasan ben Uziel. There are some things in this Targum that prove they were after Yonasan, long after Yonasan ben Uziel. Right? Some things in Targum Yonasan ben Uziel to the Torah... Here's the best proof of this, is that nowhere in Rashi's, Ibn Ezra, Ramban, the major Rishon Rashbam, the major Rishonim never mentioned Targum Yonasan to the Torah. If it was available and it existed, you'd think that Rishonim would at least mention it once in all their writings? Tosfos mentions a few times in Shas, Targum Yerushalmi al HaTorah. Right? The first person to ever quote the Targum Yonasan to the Torah was a student of Ramban, Menachem Harakanti. That's the late 13th century. Right? So I don't think it'd be very hard to make an argument that the author of this thing here that says Jonas ben Uziel was actually the student of Hillel named Jonas ben Uziel. Right? So what is this other commentary here, this other Targum called Yerushalmi? Most Mikros Gedolos today that are newly printed don't include it. Most of them don't include Jonas and Uziel either, for the reason I just told you. It's not him. Right? But most certainly don't include Yerushalmi, for the reason that if you turn some pages, you'll find, see, not here. Right? Not here. How the editors of Mikros Gedolos, the two major Mikros Gedolos printed in the 20th century, that decided that because we have in our hands an additional fragmentary Targum in Aramaic, that it's worthwhile to spend space on some pages and put it in. There are 5,845 psukim in the Torah. We only have about 500 of them of this Targum. And they're not even on the whole psukim. So why put one? It's approximately one-tenth. Look, open up to any page, you're not going to see it. Just Yonas ben Uziel, Yonas ben Uziel, right? And just turn to random to pages that's on this page, it has a little few psukim Yerushalmi. But, so, it doesn't make sense. I just want you to know what it is. Okay, there is two Targumim to the Torah. Both could be Tuf Yud. Remember, we had something like this before this semester with the 22 years and the 40 years, 20 years of Shimshon, 40 years of Shimshon, 20 twice, 20 plus 2, 20 times 2, with a mistake the posters talked about. Right? Remember that? As far as Shalom and Cholik Olam. Right? So this is part of why we have to be very careful about how we transcribe things, obviously. So this basically closes our discussion on Targum, right? So what we did at the end of just before the vacation, I think some of you were out, was how we compare Biblical Hebrew with other Semitic languages that were popularly spoken at the time and the prophets spoke, right? Stands to reason that if you have Semitic languages that are surrounding Israel, that Hebrew either helped those languages or those languages helped Hebrew. Right? Remember, we talked about this right before the vacation. If you missed that class, please make sure to listen online. And it was the class just before the vacation. The date, I think, is maybe September 26th. And then let's take a look at the date right before you get there. So the main languages we discussed were Akkadian, Ugaritic, and Arabic. How understanding how those languages appear in ancient times will help us understand difficult Hebrew words. Right? Okay, these are nations mentioned in Tanakh even, and these are people who live just in the surrounding areas. It should be so patently obvious to be able to explain biblical words this way, because the Talmud even uses Chomite and Yefet word languages to help understand difficult Hebrew terminologies. Remember the examples I gave last class? Last class, maybe? No? Totafot. V'hayula totafot peinecha. The Gemara says it's not a Hebrew word. It's a Chomite word. And in Chomite, this is what it means. Chomite means it's an African language, and this is what it means in those languages, and that helps us understand what it means in Hebrew. Talmud also does this with Greek. Priates hador. The Gemara says that it's better if the esrog grows near water. Why? Because hador means hydra. H-D-R means water in Greek. So it must mean that the Torah is giving a hint to a Greek language. What? Greek, Hebrew is Semitic. All right. Sometimes languages borrow from one another. Open up a Scrabble dictionary and you'll see hundreds of words from other languages. Right? Go down the page of SHM and you'll see 40 Yiddish words that you can use in Scrabble now. Shmir. Right? Okay. So that's just something we typically take for granted. Right? The word hain, meaning one. Hain, meaning one, is all over the Talmud Bavli. That the word hain in Hebrew in the Torah doesn't mean them, it means one. If a man sleeps with his wife's mother, the Torah says, you shall burn him and them. Them? What did his wife do wrong? Wife's mother is a big schlub, but what did she do wrong? You have to burn them, right? So the Gemara gives two answers to this question, one of which is, eshen means, no, not both of them, one of them, right? Really? Isn't there a better way for the Torah to say that? Right? But still, the fact that the Gemara thought it could answer the question this way, it rejects that answer afterwards, but Rabbi Shmuel gives that answer, right? So, very strange. So I'm just mentioning these Gemaras to you as proof that the rabbis were open to explaining difficult Hebrew phrases or words using Chomite and Yefet languages, Kal v'Chomer. We will have no problem, and this is what we're going to start to do next class. We'll go into the ancient Near East using ancient Semitic languages. Right? I think everyone can wrap their hands around that. Okay? All right, guys. Thursday, we will be having the exam will start into the class. We're going to start the class at a particular time in the class. Not starting at 9, the exam will start at approximately 9:25.